Dennis Stromat is a fiddler, and he was just beginning his studies at Southwest Missouri State University back in the 90s when a folklore professor made a passing reference to a little-known dialect of French once spoken nearby. The offhanded remark sent Dennis on a whole journey to find out if anyone still spoke Missouri French. He shared the story with me in July of 2014. Let's listen back to that conversation now. Hi, Dennis. How's it going?
Good. Doing good. How are you?
Great. So tell me more about your initial decision to go seeking out the last vestiges of that old Missouri French. What piqued your curiosity?
Well, actually, I'm from Southern Illinois, and I live in Southern Illinois. And growing up near Vincennes, Indiana, which is also a French community, they used to have 12th night balls and rendezvous. In fact, the rendezvous still continue today. But back in the 70s, I remember all these things as a kid, some of the events, you know, that were going on in the area, some of the old French events. But no one spoke French. And probably at around the age of about 14 or 15, I ended up traveling over to St. Genevieve, Missouri, and seeing some of the homes in St. Genevieve, because the largest number of French Creole-style homes, architecture, is actually in the state of Missouri. Not in Canada, not in Louisiana. The largest number are in the state of Missouri, and especially in St. Genevieve.
Interesting.
And I thought this was wonderful, and the beautiful homes, but my question was, well, we've got this great architecture, but what happened to the culture?
Yeah.
People lived in these homes. People built these homes. Did they just vanish? Did the French families vanish? I mean, there were, you know, when you read a history book, you know, the history of the French in our area, Southern Illinois, Southern Indiana, Southeast Missouri, is a blip in a lot of ways. In fact, even during the bicentennial of the Lewis and Clark expedition some years ago, it was only a major discussion about what the Virginians did coming into this area, you know, and traveling up the Missouri River, you know. But there was very little mention of the fact that the greatest majority of the people on the Corps of Discovery were actually French Creoles from Southern Illinois and Missouri. They also failed to mention, you know, in many of the histories that you read, that a lot of the original charts and maps that Lewis and Clark used were actually maps that had been charted by the French cartographers 60 years before.
And so when you were noticing, Missouri, when you were noticing that, yeah, architecture, you were noticing a really very apparent kind of remain of that history, but the language thing was a little more under the surface, right?
Yeah, I mean, there's all these bits of history that are there, but you don't see anything about the language. It's what's happened. Where is it? And at Southeast Missouri State University in Cape Girardeau, I was talking with a professor, and I was talking about the architecture. We were talking about the history, and I just made some kind of offhand comment. I had only been on campus for 4 days, and I just made some kind of offhand comment that, well, I guess it's too bad that the language completely disappeared. And he kind of laughed, and he said, no, I don't think that's right. He said, I don't think the language is gone. He said, there's kind of a myth, but that, you know, he said, and who knows, he said, whether or not it's totally true or not. He said, I don't think anyone knows specifically, you know, he said, in academia anyway, of whether people or not, you know, people still speak French in the old mines area. He said, you know, there's this myth that people in the area used party line phone systems in the 60s and 70s. And the party line, if you're familiar with that, maybe some of the listeners.
I am familiar from a great Sesame Street sketch about this very subject, but
okay.
Go on.
Well, some people will know that essentially on a party line, several houses might be connected on the same phone line, and you would get different rings to know when to pick up your conversation, but other people could listen in. And this professor of mine, Dr. Nickel, told me that he had heard the story that the people would use French in the area to keep others out of their conversation. And you know, and that was one of the things that, you know, kept it alive. And we sort of had a big laugh about it, but it really piqued my interest. And I was really like, wow, could there actually be, you know, a language still living? And this was, back in 1990.
Did you go straight to Old Mines, or did you have to go on a bit of a wild goose chase?
Well, there was kind of a goose chase. I went to Potosi first and stopped at a gas station, and I talked to a guy at a gas station, and I decided I'd just go up there. It was Labor Day weekend, and I figured I had the time. I would go up and just mill about and see what I could find. I stopped at a gas station. I asked a gentleman there, you know, if he knew any French people, and he kind of looked at me strangely, and I told him that I was a student out in Cape Girardeau, and so he, all of a sudden, he already knew that there was something weird about me, and he's like, well, yeah, I'm French. He's like, my family's French. People in my family speak some French. And I was like, well, do you speak any French? And he's like, no, I don't speak any French. And he's like, but if you keep going up, you know, go up Route 21 up into Old Mines. He said, you might stop up there. He said, there might be, you know, some people there that, you know, could help you. So I drove on up into Old Mines, and I stopped at a little, it was kind of a little pantry grocery store in the middle of town near the Casey Hall. And I stopped in there, and I asked a lady, you know, I told her who I was, where I was from, and I asked her if she spoke any French or knew any French, and she actually kind of looked at me funny, and she said, yeah, I speak a little French. And I said, well, that's great. I do too. I said, I took some French in college. Well, I had taken one semester, and I got like a C in it.
So you knew bonjour.
Yeah, exactly. But I told her, you know, that the school part, and then she just clammed up. And she said, no, I won't speak with you because you don't speak real French.
Whoa.
And I was like, real French. And she was like, yeah, you know, school French. She said, that's not our French. I didn't understand that there was a difference.
What is the difference?
Well, there is a huge difference. Actually, dialect is different. Some word choices are different. You know, vocabulary, syntax of verb grammar are somewhat different. It's all understandable. Even if you speak standard French, you can understand if you listen really closely to Missouri and Illinois French, you can understand. And I say Missouri and Illinois French because Old Mines French, as a lot of people call it, is just Missouri and Illinois French. It's not just Old Mines French. This was a French language that was very much alive in Prairie de Roche, Illinois, and Cahokia, Illinois, Kaskaskia, Illinois, Vincennes, Indiana. This whole area, you know, at one time. So that's why I call it, you know, essentially Illinois French.
How did it happen to survive in Old Mines for so much longer than in other places? Did this community exist in isolation? Is that the explanation?
Yes. And that is a big part of it. And a lot of that was because of the lead mining industry. Lead mining, it's very much on the eastern edge of the Ozarks. It's very hilly. It's very rough terrain. And there wasn't a great deal of public road access into the area, you know, until the early 20th century. And this would give, and not only that, but I mean, this would give, you know, essentially a buffer. And not only that, but because there was such a massively large population of French in the area, see, what would happen is when the Americans came into Vincennes, many of the French families left. Many stayed, but a lot of Anglos came into Vincennes. Some, you know, Anglos started pouring into southern Illinois in the early 1800s, you know, late 1800s or late 1700s. And this would push a lot of French families over the Mississippi River into Missouri. And many of them ended up going to Old Mines because it was a very active mining community, very many small communities in such a, you know, vast internal area, you might say. I mean, you know, anywhere from Herculaneum and Infestus, Missouri, all the way down to Fredericktown, you have this entire area of French settlements on either side of what is now Route 21, going towards Route 67.
Dennis, I've heard you described as an adopted son of Old Mines. Can you talk more about your relationship with the people of Old Mines? What was going on in your own life when you headed down there?
Well, you know, when I first went to Old Mines, like I say, it was really out of curiosity more than anything. But what happened was I was eventually led to the parish workers in Fertile, and they would introduce me, and there were several ladies out there actually out on the porch the day I went, and it was that day that I actually first heard the language, and I was so fascinated. I wanted to know more, and so I was able to get myself invited to some house parties, and I literally just started going every weekend, staying with different people, sleeping on floors if I had to, and sort of took up with a gentleman named Roy Bouyer, who kind of felt sorry for me. I was trying to learn how to play fiddle, and I just wanted to learn how to play any kind of fiddle. And he lived in Cadet, and he was a barber, and he invited me over to his place, and I started going and visiting with him a lot. And in fact, he would even teach me tunes. I would sometimes have to spend whole days, but he would teach me tunes between haircuts and just to learn songs. And via that and spending a lot of time with different singers, and in fact, Miss Annie Paggi, she was just a great, great singer and was so knowledgeable about the language. And I got to spend a lot of time with her, others like Ida Portell, Marguerite Portell Polite, and Robert Robart. These were different individuals who were just so knowledgeable about the language, knowing stories, knowing songs. And I guess in a lot of ways, maybe they got a kick out of the fact that I was just so interested. And I just really wanted to know these songs. I wanted to know these stories. And, well, when you work in the language, eventually what happens is, well, you begin to understand it.
So as you learned really the songs, you started understanding the language.
Yeah, I started understanding the language, but then I was talking to a lot of these people in French, too. And in some cases, they would sort of play with me and use me as kind of a guinea pig. They, you know, if I was at their house and I would want to eat, you know, they would make me ask for it in French. And, you know, and so if I didn't ask, I didn't get to eat. And so I learned, you know, how to say spoon, le cuillère, you know, fourchette, you know, assiette, you know, and I started learning all these different things. And eventually you're putting full sentences together, having conversations. And all of a sudden, you know, after 2 to 3 years, there's this realization that I speak this language and that I can work within this language. And I guess through that, I really kind of became my second home. Go ahead.
Oh, I was just wondering if you have a favorite phrase in Missouri French.
Oh, I don't know if I have one, but something that I'm used to saying when I see people, you know, in old minds, you know, comme c'est ça va, you know, comme c'est ça va, which means, hey, how's it going? You know, which is different than, you know, standard French.
Yeah, they just say ça va.
Ça va, or comment allez-vous, you know, but in old minds, I mean, in Missouri, Illinois French, it's, hey, comme c'est ça va? And, of course, the answer is hopefully, ça va bien, toi, you know, and it means it's going good. How about you, you know? And so, you know, just things like that, you know, I get a real warm feeling, you know, about the language and, you know, about the music and the people, you know.
Dennis, do you still perform the songs regularly that you learned in Old Mines?
Oh yeah, quite a bit. You know, it was kind of one of those things that just sort of snowballed. I learned the tunes just because I enjoyed them. I never knew anybody would want to hear them. You know, not anything against the songs, but I never knew that there would be a demand out there for people really wanting to hear these songs. And I find myself playing all over the United States. And I've performed at the Library of Congress, at the Kennedy Center doing these songs. I get an opportunity to do these tunes at least, you know, 5-6 times a month. You know, getting to play in Old Mines too, you know, once or twice a year. And I still go over and do some bouillon parties, some house parties, and when I get a chance to play. And,
hey, Dennis.
You know, but, Dennis, but I get to play all over.
How do you say our time is up in Missouri French?
Yeah, c'est tout fini.
All right, well, our time is up, or as they might say in Old Mines, c'est tout fini. That conversation with Dennis Stromat originally aired in July of 2014. Right after this break, we'll dig into the roots of funk music. I'm Gina Kaufman. This is KCUR's Central Standard. Don't go away. I'm Gina Kaufman, and this is KCUR's Central Standard. Now, let's get funky. If you listen closely, this song by Funkadelic will reveal the story of funk music. That's according to our next guest, who we're calling the Professor of Funk, Tony Bolden, with us now from KU's Department of African and African American Studies. Good morning.
Good morning.
Hearing this song in your car, you had an epiphany, right?
I did. I had been thinking about this concept for a long time. And I had listened to that song for years and years and years. And
when you say you were thinking about a concept, what concept?
The concept of funk.
Oh, okay.
Yeah.
The whole concept of funk.
Right. And I had just written a book. And in the book was about black poetry and music and jazz and blues. And I had argued that the poets were essentially expressing the concepts of the music in their styles and in their sort of philosophies. After I published the book, I said to myself, Tony, if that's true, if this is how we account for the poetry, how then do we account for the music? How do we explain the music, right? And my idea was that funk was a kind of central core to it, but I couldn't connect it in any tangible way that made sense. And one day I heard this song and I said, oh, something about the music. And in the song, there are a number of dances that are mentioned. The monkey wasn't funky anymore. The chicken wasn't picking and so forth. But it was only when she did the freak with me that it was really funky. And the freak at that time of the recording was the new dance. And I had spent a lot of time on the dance floor. And so I knew all of those dances.
Can you describe the freak?
The freak was, you did it sort of, you had a sideways step into the rhythm, and you waved your arms in a way that I don't know, it was sort of freaky.
That makes sense.
Right. It's actually, there was also a song called "Love Freak" by the band Chic at the time as well. So, so if you knew the dances, a lot of people who, you know, don't know the dances, but if you know the dances, then the song is, you can read it like a poem. And I said, oh, that's what he's talking about. So throughout the history of the music, the whole point was to make people happy, to create those kind of goosebumps that you feel when your favorite song comes on, and you wanna tap your feet, you wanna nod your head, and hopefully get on the dance floor. And that's what that song was about.
Talk to me about the word funk.
The word funk, it's really complex. I'll try to nail it down as well as I can, because you've got three different strains there. There's the English word funk, which had no connotation whatsoever, just meant a strong smell. There was an African word called lufuki, and that also meant smell, but it had a positive connotation to it because it was associated with musical performance. And of course, traditional African societies didn't have access to air conditioning. And so when a performer was really put his or her heart into the music, they would, of course, expend a great deal of energy and perspire. And so the actual smell was a sign of that artist's honesty and integrity, if that makes sense.
Yeah, like it was really good, and you could tell by the way it smelled. People were
precisely
moving.
Precisely. And then there was a third strain. Once you get to the early part of blues culture, hopefully we can talk about that, in late 19th century, early 20th century. And in black blues southern culture, the word funk was associated with the other F word. So it had to do with sexuality. It was the smell of sex, right? So you have three sort of commingled strands that sort of cross-fertilized with each other.
Wow, I wasn't expecting it to go there, but I guess I'm not that surprised, really. I mean, what got you interested in researching funk music academically? What did you wonder about the genre that you thought you could answer from that approach? You talked about that you had already danced on the dance floor, like you're listening to the song in your car. That's a different kind of research.
Yeah, it is. Well, as a literary scholar and an old poet, I initially tried to use literary materials, and I did that for many years, and I ultimately figured out that none of those theories, none of those critical methodologies were going to work. One day I remember that my father, who I was into jazz, and my father wanted to introduce me to a new jazz musician when I was fresh out of the Army. And this was during the funk era. And he said, "Tony, I want to introduce you to Horace Silver." And Horace Silver was a bebop musician, but he played funky. And this, I knew he wasn't talking about James Brown. That he knew that I knew what that word meant. And so I began to use, to search out for musicology, scholars of musicology and dance criticism, and that was sort of the hook that provided the sort of key or access into the concept. But I had been sort of doing this for a long time. I actually had I organized the first academic conference on funk in 2007. So it's actually 10 years ago at University of Alabama. So I had been trying to engage it ever since the completion of my book, which was in 2004.
But why do you think it's important to know the origins and like the roots of funk music? Why not just listen to it and dance?
I see. Well, intellectuals always try to figure stuff out. The answer to your question is that I realized, you know, that it was philosophical. That's really the answer to your question. That there were principles encoded in the word and in the styles were both specifically related to African-American culture, but also were universal in nature. Funk music, the actual genre itself, is unthinkable without the civil rights struggle of the 60s. And there was a time before that when the word black and the word funk was stigmatized in black culture, and you're something you couldn't say, you weren't supposed to say in polite company or in public. And it was only after James Brown recorded the song "I'm Black and I'm Proud" in 1968 that began to really change. There was another guy named Sly Stone that was really important too, but what happened is that working class black people and artists, when they heard people saying, black isn't bad in and of itself, that, you know, black, you know, all this pride stuff about black pride, they heard the word funk and the actual concept of funk. And people had been using euphemisms for years, like soul, swing, all these different words really mean the same thing in terms of emotional emotional referent, but you couldn't say the other word. And so what it really does, and the reason I thought it was important to research, is it had to do with an experience that African-American people have created and contributed to the United States. And there's something very special about it.
What would you say was your biggest aha moment as you began really digging into this stuff? A moment when you started seeing, like, big connections and you thought, okay, this is amazing.
A lot of those. Probably when I realized that Bessie Smith, the blues singer, used the word funk. That was a big aha, because I knew that I had always felt that it wasn't unique to the genre of funk between the late 60s and 70s and early 80s. I'd always known that, but I hadn't been able to prove it. There was also a swing musician. I think he played with Count Basie, whose name I forget right now, who said that when they had used the word swing in the 30s, they really meant the word funky. But again, that was something that they would say among fellow musicians, not something they would say in public. So those were two really important aha moments. There were a number of different books as well. Guy Ramsey's book, Race Music, was important. So yeah, just a lot of different things that, you know, you sort of different levels of aha, I guess you would say.
Yeah. Does Kansas City enter the story at all? We play such a big part in the history of jazz, but I haven't heard a lot about Kansas City funk, although Marva Whitney was from here.
Exactly. She's really important. She's important for two reasons. One, actually a lot of reasons, because she's a prototypical funk singer in the sense that most of the great funk singers, with the exception of Chaka Khan, who does not come out of the church, but the vast majority of the great funk singers grow up singing gospel. And so she is characteristic in that respect. She's also part of James Brown's band in its prime. And the record shows that she played a big part in sort of contributing to the uniqueness of his sound. But also because, as with all movements, funk had its contradictions. And so she talks about this in her memoir, but there was an element of funk that was misogynist. And James Brown was one of the most responsible people for this. So this is part of the history that doesn't get talked about. So she's important for a lot of different reasons.
Just quickly, before we play one more song, you've talked about the origins of funk, but I understand that you have actually traced them back to colonial times, which I don't think I've heard you talk about yet.
Yeah, well, the actual word itself originally had no connotation whatsoever. Ultimately, it became, in the English language, in the American English, it had a connotation of immorality, and when it had to do with race, the lack of intelligence. What happens is it's actually right after it's after American independence, when Thomas Jefferson is president, and he writes the state of Virginia. And in that book, he argues that people of African descent, which is to say Negroes at the time, have a distinct malodor that is physiological, that is phenotypical, that is to say that there's nothing that, you know, people can do. You take all the showers and baths that you want, and you still smell. And it's after that you begin to get these stigmatizations that are associated with it. But what happens is blues people actually take all of those stigma and they recreate the word, essentially take the word funk and they create a new homonym with that word sound. So, you know, it's spelled the same, it sounds the same, but when they reconstructed the sign, as it were, the linguistic sign or the word, all of the emotional fervor that was stigmatized became something that they celebrated as an indication of artistic excellence, right? So it's a rather interesting sort of engagement of cultures through language, if that makes sense.
So we're going to hear a little bit more music before we go. It's a song by Sly and the Family Stone. And quickly, before we start hearing it, could you just tell us what we need to know about Sly and the Family Stone?
Well, that was a breakthrough brand, band. It was interracial. It also featured two women instrumentalists, something that still is a rarity these days. And the premise of the song is that it was anti-racism, any sort of way that you would think about it. So in the song, the trumpeter, Cynthia Robinson, is going to say, "All the squares go home." I don't know if we'll be able to hear that far into it, but she says, "All the squares go home, not all the black people, not all the white people. The opposition is between the squares and the people who are hip," right? And
who that could be perhaps funky.
Funky is a better word for it.
Well, this is Sly and the Family Stone's Dance to the Music. And, you know, you've said a little bit about what you hear in this, but can you talk about it a little bit more musically?
Well, you have, for the first time, you have Larry Graham, the bass player, who is using rock techniques. I think he's using his fuzz box there.
Yeah. Well, basically, we're hearing Awesome and Tony Bolden from the studios of KPR in Lawrence. This has been really fun.
All right. Thank you very much.
We are going to go out on this song, and we will be right back. I'm Gina Kaufman. This is KCUR Central Standard. I'm Gina Kaufman. Our friends who make the podcast Question Quest have been obsessing about a story that just keeps getting weirder and more elaborate. In January, Cody Newell and Suzanne Hogan investigated the odd statue in Brookside. It's a statue of a lady who, for some reason, is surrounded by little bird figures. In a recent episode of Question Quest, Cody and Suzanne thought they'd solved the mystery, but more has revealed itself. Here are Suzanne and Cody with the final report on Brookside's Bird Lady.
Last time on Question Quest.
There's a statue at like 52nd and Brookside. It's covered in gifted birds, like porcelain birds, plastic birds. She'll have a crown of flowers.
I like calling her the Bird Lady, and that's kind of how we started to...
It's a better name, the Bird Lady.
That statue wasn't always there. It was actually a fountain, the dolphin and the boy.
There was no rhyme or reason why they chose this statue.
And then I also had some people on the ground start, like, spying on the statue over time.
Just this morning, as luck would have it, we got an email from a lady named Margaret Sonnenberg.
I have to assume it's just, like, old women or witches or whatever, you know.
I made origami paper cranes, and hopefully that whoever was doing this would be moved to get in touch with me, and I wrote messages on them to try to convince whoever was doing this to get in touch.
And then I just ruined it.
Yes, it is a geocache.
I know I'm the number one cacher in Kansas, and that's all I care about. I know I have over 70,000.
That means she gets 21 caches per day.
I don't know, maybe it's a chicken and the egg thing. I don't know if the geocache was first or if people were already putting figurines there beforehand.
I still stand by that not everybody who's leaving birds there are doing it because it's a geocache.
Right.
And I still stand by that there is someone or some people who are doing things to keep it looking nice.
Hello, Question Quest listeners. This is Cody.
And Suzanne.
So what you just heard is a recap of the last episode, a live episode we did, where we brought you the story of what we called the Bird Lady statue in Kansas City's Brookside neighborhood.
We found out most of the answers about like where it came from and why people were putting birds there, but we didn't really have all the answers.
Until now.
Yes, so if you haven't listened to that episode, you should probably just go back and do that. But just to give a quick summary, when we last left off, we had a few big questions. One, who put the first bird at the statue? Two, who was taking care of the statue and keeping the area around it looking clean? And then three, was the geocache first or were the birds there first?
And now for this special bonus episode, we finally have the answers to those questions.
So we can put this to bed and do other things.
Finally, we can do other things after months of keeping our eyes on a statue.
This is all I've been doing, really. No, I'm kidding.
No, so a few weeks ago, a package mysteriously showed up at the station. And it had one of the origami birds that we left at the statue on it. And inside were some interesting photographs of the Bird Lady statue.
Is that a dead bird?
Is it?
In the front?
Oh, no. Oh, my God. I think there actually is a dead bird in the front.
Needless to say, it was an exciting moment.
We were pretty stoked. And there were also photos of other statues around town that were mounted on little mat boards. And on the back of one of them, he's got a phone number on this one. Yes. Okay, cool. So this is from a T.R. Gasper, photographer of the unusual.
And inside the package, there was also a copy of a letter. Now, this letter we found at the statue. It was in this little hole, like at the base of the statue, but we could barely read it because it had been pretty severely damaged from the weather. And the reason we didn't mention this letter in the last episode is because we didn't want to ruin the surprise about what the geocache was, because we thought that the letter was, you know, part of the geocache thing.
Observe the etiquette.
Yes. But this fresh copy of the letter had the name T.R. Gasper written at the bottom.
Another crazy part, Mike Russo, our events producer at the station, he said that he knows another guy, the guy who started the actual geocache, who is a different guy than this. So there's some crazy stuff going on.
Okay.
So there's more threads to this story.
So it continues.
So I called this T.R. Gasper, and he was totally game to come talk about the statue.
Cody, it's Tom here. Test 1, 2, 3.
T.R. Gasper is Tom Gasper. He's retired and spends a lot of his days shooting photographs, like with an actual camera, something you don't really see a whole lot nowadays.
I started out as a portrait photographer, and I love doing pictures of people. But now everybody's got these little the phones. This is why it makes me mad. Everybody's got the phones. So it's not special to take a photograph of anyone anymore. So people kind of blow it off.
So Tom started taking photos of statues.
And Kansas City is full of statues and fountains, like hundreds of them.
Yeah, there's like this myth that Kansas City has like the second most fountains behind Rome. But I don't think that's ever been like actually confirmed. That's probably another quest to figure that out.
That's not true.
I looked it up and it didn't seem like it was necessarily true. I think it's just one of those like urban legend. I don't even know if it's an urban legend. Is that considered an urban legend? It's like a thing that goes around. Most people know about it. Anyways, Tom found himself taking more and more photos of statues around town.
I've always photographed the statue at Nichols Fountain in the wintertime when there's no water running, so I can get in and walk around in there.
Just a note, if you aren't from Kansas City, J.C. Nichols Memorial Fountain is easily the most well-known fountain in the city. It's this big circular patio with these four horsemen that are meant to symbolize the four rivers of the world, the Mississippi, the Volga, the Seine, and the Rhine. And sometimes the water gets like dyed different colors to celebrate different events. The last one I remember was when they dyed the water like royal blue because the Kansas City Royals were in the World Series.
And I think they do that on opening day too.
And this fountain sits right outside of a big shopping district called the Country Club Plaza, another thing that was built by J.C. Nichols, if you remember the last episode. And you can always find people gathering around it when the weather is nice. But anyways, here's Tom again.
And then I get these weird angles against the clouds or with the statue that's across the street called Faith, the one on top of the Cheesecake Factory. That one's always been my prime objective. I've shot that about 30 different times.
So Tom was walking around the Nichols Fountain, and he saw that there were some wish pennies left over from the summertime.
And they were a little bit tore up. They were rusty. If pennies can rust, they deteriorated somehow. And I thought that nobody wanted them.
This was, at the very least, 5 years ago, probably closer to, like, 10 years ago. Tom can't really exactly remember when, but he was living in Brookside at the time, and he'd taken some photos of the Bird Lady statue, and he immediately noticed her empty goblet.
And I kept on thinking, well, should I put a big can of beer in there or something, you know, so that when I drive by, it'll be kind of funny, and because I drive by it all the time, you know, it'll be funny for me.
But instead, Tom thought he'd put those forgotten wish pennies in her goblet as a way to kind of keep those wishes intact. But then something happened that he didn't really expect.
As I was doing that, a little bird flew down and started, you know, messing around up there. And I thought, well, my goodness, this is something. I'm making a story out of this.
So Tom wrote this story about his photography, about the statue and the bird to amuse his grandkids, and put that in the hole of the base of the statue. That's the letter that we found when we first went there.
And Tom was also the first person to put a bird figurine there.
I took a bird there and I stuck it in that thing there with some pennies, and then I thought, well, next time I drove by there, I went to the thrift store, I got another bird for a buck. I never paid more than a buck for a bird.
And so he started doing that every once in a while, and pretty soon other people started putting birds there too, and he showed me some letters that he had gotten over the years of people who had left messages for him and wanted to know more about it, kind of just like we did with the origami birds. And he also told me that he's the person that cleans up the statue every couple of months or so.
Right. People tell me about it sometimes, you know, when they see it.
Yeah.
And because they know about it, that I did it, and they go, hey, it's still there.
Yeah.
I'm surprised they didn't clean it up, you know, the city cleaned it up or something, but they leave it alone. I cleaned it up.
So that solved a pretty huge mystery for us. I mean, this is the person behind keeping the Bird Lady statue looking good. As we talked about in the previous episode, you know, the KCATA or the Neighborhood Association both said it wasn't them. So finding out that it was Tom was such a great answer to the question.
And makes a ton of sense because we never saw, like, any officials there, and it would make sense that it's just this guy just every once in a while goes out there, cleans it up for 10 minutes, and leaves. So now we knew that Tom was the keeper of the statue, but even he didn't know about the geocache that was placed there in 2013. So through our events producer, Mike, we tracked down this guy, Andy Michael, an independent filmmaker in town.
Myself and my family decided to start geocaching when we realized that we really needed to be outside more, do less video gaming. And so we were living in Waldo at the time, and we'd been walking the trolley trail, walked past this mysterious statue quite a few times, and realized that people had put figurines on it.
And after he was geocaching for a while, Andy says it changed the way that he started looking at the world. Like, he'd see a hole in a tree and think, that could be a good spot for a geocache. So he and his family decided to start their own cache at the Bird Lady statue.
The container that we made initially...
At the Bird Lady statue.
The container that we made initially was just a small container, maybe about an inch long, and we stuck a feather to it just to match the theme of the Bird Lady, and it seemed appropriate to call it Put a Bird on It, just because we'd recently been watching Portlandia and seen that skit.
Putting a bird on toast.
Put a bird on it!
Look at this.
I just sold this bird right onto the pillow.
Oh, of all the caches that we hid, and we only hid a handful, that was definitely prime placement for a lot of foot traffic, and so it was. Yeah, we're getting emails all the time that someone else had found it, and then of course people take a picture and leave it in the log.
But after a while, Andy and his family kind of ended up drifting away from geocaching, and the Put a Bird on It cache was marked inactive on the geocaching website, meaning that it wouldn't show up on the app and people couldn't just try to find the cache anymore.
But, you know, people keep putting bird figurines on there. And, you know, we did this episode, and now some other types of figurines have been put there. And this is where it starts to get a little crazy. Like, I've been getting so many texts about this new development. My mom called me. My old boss called me. We got so many emails. I mean, this was just, it seemed like the talk of the neighborhood.
It was the talk of, like, the internet, too. Like, I got a ton of emails. We posted it to our KCUR Instagram account, and people were hitting me up from that.
Just a few weeks ago, somebody put a ring of cat figurines around the birds, like surrounding the entire statue.
Like at least 20 of them, maybe more. And a bunch of people told us that they had to be from this nearby estate sale that had dozens and dozens and dozens of cat figurines for sale. Like $5 for all you could carry out of this place. And then if cats weren't enough, somebody just told you that there were some other new additions too, right?
Yeah, talk about next level. The levels keep coming. Last night, my roommate told me that somebody has put dog figurines now, like, surrounding the birds from the cats. Like, they're set up
to protect them from the cats that are, like, looking on.
Right. So, who knows where this will end.
And for Tom and Andy, I think they would be pretty pleased that this happened, too. Because for them, it's all about getting people involved with this bird lady statue.
I think a lot of people should participate in art. Yeah. It's not hard to think of. It's not hard to do. It's how art should be.
I think we all like to be part of something bigger than ourselves. And even if it's a statue with birds on it, it feels good and it feels like you're being included in something without needing anyone's permission. It's not just monkey see, monkey do. It's like, well, I'm going to put my own bird on there because if it was okay for these people to do it, then it's okay for me as well. And so I'm going to put a bird on it.
All right, instead of trivia this week, Cody, quick flash answer. What will be the next crazy thing that is left at the Bird Lady statue?
I'd like to see foxes. I like foxes. They're cute little animals. Maybe squirrels? I just want more animals. I want it to become like an animal kingdom around the statue. That's what I really want. What do you think is going to be the next one?
I'm torn between like humans or dinosaurs.
Dinosaurs. Yes. Man, we really need dinosaurs around that thing. Please, somebody put dinosaurs around the statue.
But I'm not getting involved anymore. I'm putting this to bed. Yeah. I got other things to do.
Yeah, we're done. We can't make any more episodes or posts about this statue. I think our bosses are going to kill us if we do.
Well, that's it for our special episode of Question Quest, looking deeply into a topic. Thanks for listening. If you want to get in touch with us, you can send us an email, questionquest@kcur.org, or you can follow Cody on Twitter. He's at Cody Newell, and our show is at QQ_podcast.
Music this week is by Suzanne, Harry Gregson-Williams, John Watts, Dr. Turtle, and Blue Dot Sessions.
Special thanks to everybody who reached out to us and for tipping us off to all the different developments with this Bird Lady statue. It really was a community effort, and the only reason we got to the bottom of this was because of you guys, so thanks.
Super awesome.
Our producers are Sylvia Maria Gross and Brianna O'Higgins. I'm Suzanne Hogan, and you are?
Cody Newell.
Thanks for listening.
Thanks, guys.
You know, I'm gonna miss that story. I hope some other weird thing happens, something so weird involving the Bird Lady statue,
that Suzanne and Cody have to come back to it. If you want to hear the previous installment of this saga, Question Quest is available on iTunes, Google Play, etc., etc. And that's a wrap. It's been fun sharing stories with you all today, and guess what? We can do it some more tonight. I'm hosting a storytelling event at Knucklehead starting at 7. The theme is Up All Night. Grab some coffee on the way. Storytellers include a late-night barista, a Radiohead fan, a mischievous teenager armed with walkie-talkies, and our own Michael Byers. Go to kcur.org to learn more. Tomorrow, tune in for a food show about chicken and eggs. Eggs will come first. KCUR's Central Standard is produced by Matthew Long Middleton, Sylvia Maria Gross, Jen Chen, Andrea Tudhope, and Suzanne Hogan. Caitlin Troutman is our intern. I'm Gina Kaufman. Up to date is right around the corner.